and dimensions.
That's an issue that is going to spur another conversation. So those of you who don't know Dr. Jessica Clement, she's right here. And is it Clement or Clement?
Clement.
And I'm going to do a little bit of reading of her background. I certainly know her from her career here at Colorado State University at the Colorado Forest Restoration Institute. And she's just done amazing things with that group, and I'm hoping that that's what all this is about today, at least some of that. But she has a really, before she came and kind of came over to the side of trees, she was a journalist, or at least she was studying journalism, and natural resource policy is one of her things. And she just has a very varied background. She's been in the private sector. She was an associate dean at Colorado Mountain College. So sort of, has this really broad, all the way from science to administration, social science, policy, and things like that. And so every time I talk to Jessica, I learn something way new that I'd never thought of before. And I think today we're going to learn that again. So please welcome.
Thank you, Robin. You're very kind. So what do I do to just this here?
Yeah,
you
can put down here.
Yes,
ma'am.
Oops.
Good morning or afternoon, everyone. Very nice to see you. Lots of familiar faces. Happy New Year, belatedly.
Happy New Year.
The Center for Collaborative Conservation, I jumped on the opportunity because I had been walking around with an idea for quite some time. On the one hand, I had discussed so often with colleagues at International Symposium for Society and Natural Resource, this sort of dichotomy that seems to exist, this divide, or it appears to be, between my field of social science. I'm also a forest ecologist, but my research is social science, human dimensions and natural resources. And how to get that in such a way to managers and decision makers so they can actually use it. And there appeared to me to be a paradox, and we've all talked about this in my field, we've talked about it a lot, and I know that lots of us are thinking about finding ways to cross the great divide. But so I, thanks to this funding, was able to go on my own little journey on this, and I wanted to share with you what I've done and what I've found out. So first I'm going to explain this paradox, at least from my perspective. I don't have very much on literature yet, that's the next phase, but I'll tell you what I do know. Talk about the science delivery that I've done and how that worked out, what the results were, and the summary. So the first thing is that there appears to be a paradox to me, like I said. On the one hand, agencies are unfamiliar and untrained in social science. They don't know what it is, they're very unfamiliar with what our methods are. They're clueless, very often, utterly clueless about what the value is. And yet, on the other hand, the role that social science can play in this increasingly complex natural resource world is, in my mind, can become more and more important and actually more and more relevant and very much more helpful. So that's the paradox that I see. Our colleagues in agencies are very often very well versed in the natural science commissions. At the same time, we have legislation like HEFRA, Healthy Forest Restoration Act, or the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Act, which both mandate thou shalt, Forest Service, engage in collaboration. Well, collaboration is usually you don't have a bunch of horses together, it's really people. So, how to get people together, working together, it's about human dimensions, right? So there too, the imperative for using social science increases. And then on the other hand, like I said, I'm under the impression that my colleagues and I have, for the 20 years that I've been in social science, we're talking about how to make social science more relevant. And many of us have engaged in trying to find ways of making it more relevant. But I think this is really a conclusion that I have, but I'll get to it right now. Right now, I can tell you that I really think there is a role for a far more concerted, collaborative, among social scientists effort. There is a need for this, to engage with that with natural sciences and with agencies. So with this fellowship, like I said, I started exploring the subject on my own turf, in my own ways. And I wanted to find ways to integrate social science data that I collected in 2007 and 2008, very much with Kathy's help, on the Bridger Teton National Forest. I looked at the literature a little bit, but I have not done a proper literature review. I'm getting to that point right now. But from what I can tell right now, it does appear to me that in the forest sciences and ecological sciences, the subject of science delivery mechanisms has been more systematically explored than in human dimensions. If somebody wants to correct me, I'd love it. But from what I can tell, just a very superficial look, and from my impressions, that's my impression, to be followed with more research. But I'd love to hear more if anyone has any ideas. So in order to create the social science mechanism, I had a number of factors to consider. First of all, the data that I had. The data that I had is actually multidimensional. On the one hand, it's survey data, attitudes, values, preferences that people have, specifically in the context of forest planning on the BTNF, the Bridger Teton National Forest. So there's all these questions about what do you think about bicycling in a national forest? How do you feel about grazing? What are your values? And attached with that, especially the value section, was a map. So we collected spatial data regarding what the values were that people have relation to that specific landscape, so which you can use together with all kinds of other GIS layers. And then the third kind of data that I have is Q-study data, which is a more in-depth way of really getting into the subjectivity of particular issues. And it's a wonderful way, in my opinion, of finding out from stakeholders what are the trade-offs that they're seeing in relation to, in this case, the importance of forests. So right here and now in Wyoming, on the Bridger Teton National Forest, if you look at all these different things that people have to explore and weigh in decisions about forest planning, what comes out on top and what becomes less important for different kinds of stakeholders? And are there maybe trade-offs that most people agree with that could form the low-hanging fruit? So that's what the Q study data does. It goes more deeply into the issues. The context that I have is Bridger Teton National Forest, which is the second largest forest in the lower 48. It's in Wyoming. And from everything that I can tell, I don't know if any of you have had the good fortune of spending some time in Alaska, but it's socially, culturally, the closest area I know of to being approximately like Alaska, which is a good thing. But it's remote. It's remote, and the other thing that I found out through my data, and I've published about this, is that the relationship between folks on the Bridger Teton National Forest and also the Shoshone National Forest, which was another forest I've worked with, their relationship with the forest is far more visceral than we have here in Colorado. They are dependent on wildlife for their meat. 25% of the respondents were talking about being just downright dependent on the meat for their protein in their households. There's also a cultural component. I'm firmly convinced by now that if you would tell people in Wyoming that they couldn't have guns anymore, it's not so much about protecting themselves. You'd be taking away their culture. You'd be taking away their means of being able to go into forest and being the self-reliant people that they pride themselves on being. Well, I've been able to discover all that through these different kinds of data sets, and that was the context that I was working in. On top of that is oil and gas. In Wyoming, they are going through sea changes because of the fossil fuel and renewable energy developments that are happening in that state, and they're economically critically
dependent on those forms of economic income. But oil and gas in relation to this forest, people were so ardently opposed. They're very much in favor of oil and gas leasing in Wyoming, but not so much on the forests. They even went so far as to create legislation to stop oil and gas leasing for as much as possible on the Bridger Teton National Forest on the Wyoming Range, except this one area. And that's where the poor supervisor, Jackie, is having to deal with Washington, D.C., large corporations, and furious local people regarding oil and gas issues.
Mm-hmm. So the question there is, how much decision-making space does she have there? And then I had to consider the different kind of stakeholders, internal and external. I already knew, thanks to all my research, a lot about externally about the stakeholders, but this gave me an opportunity to really get to know the internal stakeholders within the agency, and that was perhaps one of the more interesting factors. But with all of this, I decided to think of science delivery as in KISS, keep it simple, stupid. So I kept it simple. But the other thing that I had to bear in mind are things related to the fact that people have very little time. They're not sure what the heck social science is, let alone how important it is and whether it's worth their time, all these factors. So what I decided to do is to create handouts. I did not use PowerPoint presentations at all. I created handouts. So I took my database and I would call, for example, Adam, who's district ranger on the Grable Ranger District. And I said, Adam, what are the big issues on your district? And he would give me a list. I would analyze the data for his place for those issues, and then I would make handouts for him. At the same time, Brian Goldberg, who is the GIS specialist on the BTNF, he made maps specifically for Adam's needs, also finely tuned to that space and to Adam's issues. So he would highlight, for example, motorized recreation trails. Then we would go and we would visit Michael Schrotz, who was in charge of this project with me on the BTNF, Brian and I, and their social scientist. Yes, they had a social scientist on this forest. The four of us would go and visit with Adam and his staff. And I would hand out the handout specifically related to his district, and then I would give him a handout to give him the data related to the whole forest. So then we could go through all that information. And after we had gone through those two sets of information, as well as the maps, there would be all this discussion, hours and hours worth. This is six ranger districts, lots of discussion. But this ties in perfectly with, if you know anything about adult learning theory, that's how we adults work. We take in complex information, we need to have time to allow it to transfer and sort of percolate within, and then we need to be able to talk about it in order for transference of the information to happen. So that's what I based my social science delivery mechanisms on, is pretty basic adult learning theory and andragogy. So I had visits with district rangers, their staff, and on a couple of occasions I went in for second meetings to visit with district ranger and, for example, big, beautiful, more about that in a minute. And then there was a third type of discussion that took place, really issue-based exploration of the data. So Jackie, the forest supervisor, she had just her hands in her hair about oil and gas. She had two big oil and gas issues right now on her hands. One is what they call PXP, and one is 447. I won't go into all the details about these two projects, but let me just summarize it by saying it comes down to decision-making space. On the one hand, Jackie is very understanding that her local constituents do not want oil and gas exploration on these chunks of land on the forest, except the county commissioners, which makes sense. So how does she, and then on the other hand, with PXP, she basically had no decision-making space. So she has to go along with that one. She has to approve. 447 is different. Because of the timing of the leasing and the timing of the corporation and when they handed in their paperwork
and got things going. She has more decision-making space. But she's got ardent current county commissioners who want this to happen. They see a lot of economic benefit. So if you look at the data that we collected in 2007, it shows very clearly that no matter where you are around her forests, people are opposed to it, which was surprising in itself, because people thought that in Sublette County, which is a county that is experiencing massive amounts of gas leasing and increasingly oil leasing as well, everybody assumes that in Sublette County, everybody's rah, rah, rah about oil and gas leasing. Well, not so much, which was a surprise for their county commissioners. On the other hand, everybody assumes that Teton County, which is very educated, I'm going to make rash generalizations here, but very educated, very liberal, that everyone there would be ardently against it. Not so much true either. So the 2007 data did a lot to illuminate assumptions that we had and to what extent they were accurate or not. And it also did show Jackie clearly that generally her constituents are against it, except the county commissioners. But the county commissioners are a very important group of people in Wyoming, and she needs to take them into consideration. So now she is thinking of asking me to do another study, specifically based on oil and gas issues, to see if we look at it right now, what are people going to say about 447 in particular, oil and gas leasing on the national forest in general. And I think that would be probably a rather controversial study. If you've been watching, reading your Headwaters news, you've been reading about Pavilion, the EPA had the audacity to test some wells, and lo and behold, they really think that they may have found some chemical compounds that were related to hydraulic fracturing. Well, the senators all over the West are not happy about the study, so I think a study like this would probably have about the same popularity, but maybe it will happen. The discoveries that I made I've always known that it's very difficult for folks, you know, for my friends in the Forest Service or the BLM or any agency, Fish and Wildlife Service, State Wildlife Agency, there is not a lot of familiar with social science. But it was a bit of an eye-opener for me to find out how little they knew. There is very little idea of the methods, what the difference is between an opinion poll and a survey that's really rooted in theory. No idea of how to use this information on any kind of scale for their projects, whether it's large landscape scale or really a project scale. No idea how to integrate the data in their documents, even NEPA documents. It's still a big question mark for a lot of folks, let alone decision making. For Jackie sees this data, she says, yes, Jess, I get the message. Folks are against it. But how do I use it? You know, how do I pick up this information and share it internally with my upper ups in Washington, D.C., with my constituents? How do I go about delivering this science, let alone using it? And then there is the fear of social science, because generally people see it as an absolute. They think, oh my goodness, if people come out very much in favor of oil and gas, does that mean we have to approve these projects? You know, they think that this is going to be the decision-making point. This is the hammer. And it's not, of course. It's another layer of information, in my opinion, a very important layer of information. But there is the assumption that it is the layer of information, and therefore decisions should be rooted on this. I disagree. I always present it as another layer to be used with many other layers for decision making. So taking away that fear or helping people digest that was helpful. And then the strategy that we use. So generally, I had within this forest, a couple of people who were very interested and very supportive. But in order to make it relevant to as many people as possible, I didn't start with the leadership and then work myself out to the districts. I did it the other way around. Because what I found out happened, I'm calling this information envy,
If you start way over here with Adam and the Great Old District, very, very remote district, and the word percolates that Adam had this woman coming over from CSU and gave him all this information. And then Adam and his county commissioner sat down with this woman and they got all these things going. There was information evident, and we all of a sudden, people previously were like, I don't want to have anything to do with it, were saying, hey, how come she's, I'm not getting any attention. I'm important. I need this information. So then I would get invitations to the other districts and it would happen organically. So what are lessons that I've learned? The need for internal gatekeepers. We all know this. If we start working with any agency, with any place, with any organization, we need our gatekeepers. And if it hadn't been for Michael Schultz and Brian Goldberg, I wouldn't have stood a chance. I would have been standing here telling you, well, you know, I had a nice trip up to Wyoming, but nothing happened. Gatekeepers, take care of them. Be very good to them. I really had to pay attention. It was really important that I frame things and did the science delivery and talked with people with full understanding that, first of all, I think this is well documented, within the Forest Service, the morale is a little low, to put it nicely. And for all sorts of reasons. They have all kinds of pieces of legislation that just do not work together at all. They have people on their backs. They have complex resource issues, very little time, all kinds of reasons. But so morale is low, there is little time, and you've got to be able to make the case that this is worth their time. So I constantly have an audience with very short attention span, and I needed to pay attention to that. It actually made, therefore, the application of andragogy and adult learning theory even more important. Without even a basic understanding of those theories, it would have been very difficult for me to understand what people need. The difference between, you know, in my opinion, I don't think we do enough of this at our conferences or our universities, but we're dealing with adults here. You are adults. And each of you comes into this room with your own set of your experiences, what your mother told you, what your father told you, your own DNA, who you are. Each of us is unique, and yet you are all very unique, complex packages. And for me to just waltz in here with complex information and think you're just going to get it like that with a PowerPoint, it's not going to happen. You've got enough going. So with these people, that was extra important. And I had to adapt accordingly. Stepping away from the projector was really helpful. Not doing the PowerPoints, having pieces of paper that they could walk away with and look at later on and share with other people. Having it on a stick so that you can just give it to people so they can download it on their PowerPoints. That way the tools are in their hands and they can use them. I think that was very helpful. And the other thing is, which is tough for, especially if we're associated with academia, is I've had to drive up there. We're going to have to look at the accounts, but I think I've driven up there. I've maybe been up there about 6 times in order to do this. And I'm not done yet. There's going to be another trip, at least in March. So it's very time intensive. So social science extension service, if you will, it's time intensive. But it's the only way I think that's going to work. So what are the outcomes, finally, of all this? One of the first presentations I did was a collaborative group in the southern end of the Wyoming Range. It was the Hams Fork Vegetation Management. Tracy was the district ranger. And they were well down the road of creating this vegetation management project. And they had a collaboration, but they hadn't really checked in with their constituents. And it was nice to be able to show them that with the empirical evidence that we have, okay, it's a little old, 2007, but it is showing that generally the way they were going about it meshed perfectly with what local people and generally people on the forest were hoping were going to. So, for example, one of the things that we're finding is that we're forest. The way respondents generally think about forest treatments is they're okay with it, but it depends why, and it depends how. if you say, I'm going to go in and clear cut this lodgepole pine forest because there's a lot of bark beetle in it, and I'm going to do it in order to create economic benefits, not going to work. At least it'll work, but it's not going to have a very large amount of support. If you want larger support, you frame it as, I'm going to go in and I'm going to do treatments in this forest, including possibly clear cuts, to help that forest regenerate itself and to help create community benefits, and couch it in a way that's really good for the forest as well as for communities. If it's just about the dollar signs, then there's not so much approval for it. It depends on why and it depends on how. And then there is massive approval. What gets the least amount of approval is not doing anything at all. So they were going about it in exactly that way, so it dovetailed perfectly with what respondents had been telling us. But this information, the thing is, they're planning this project in a roadless area. And as you know, roadless areas are getting a lot of attention. So this data made its way up to Washington, D.C. as saying, see, there is support for this project. There's still the question, I didn't ask them, are you okay with this in a roadless area? So there's more work to be done there, and that's another thing we're talking about. One of the things that I was that this project allowed me to explore is I've always thought that we can use social science to find out where and when collaboration makes sense. Because collaboration, as you know, is a very intensive undertaking. It's a critical undertaking. But applying it only where it's really going to make the most sense or really be worth the resources is very helpful. So find out where using collaboration would be optimal. Social science can help find that out. And I think, at least we found out on the Gray Bull or the Grays River District, that having the spatial information was very helpful, because the spatial information showed us where the hotspots were. There were actually value hotspots, red spots on the map that said there's all these different values that people loaded up on the map, and you can use that to tease out what kind of values. And if they conflict very much, and yet you really want to do something there, then that would be a place to center, to use collaboration for, to put all those precious dollars and time and resources into. So as well as if you then have the survey data behind it to find out what the different opinions are, first of all, it identifies a place and an issue for collaboration where it would make the most sense, but also it immediately helps start the discussion because you have information about where people are on these issues and about this place. Value of social science data to internal structure and improvement of morale. Okay, so this was really interesting. Internally, you know, the more people become familiar with you, the more they start talking. And what I found out is that, not surprising, within this particular forest, there's a cohort of people. There are different cohorts with different worldviews, with different values, and different approaches to forest management. Some are more utilitarian, some are more nature-centered. And that creates internally some friction. You combine that with this relatively low morale, and it means that a lot of subjects don't get talked about. What the social science did was, you'd get me, you know, little ignoramus me from CSU, I don't know anyone, I don't know anything, I'm just going to go blah, blah, blah here, and so I come in, and I go blah, 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 and then everybody is sitting there thinking, looking, watching, and then little by little the questions start coming up, and then you answer them based on the data, and little by little this conversation starts building up about, so what this means is X, Y, and Z. And then everybody has a chance. Fortunately, I do a lot of facilitating, so I immediately launch into facilitator mode and facilitate this conversation. And one of the things that came out, one of the areas, I keep talking about the Grays River District, but that is where people all of a sudden latched onto something that they all agreed on, which was collaboration about travel management with the county commissioners. And
Adam asked me to come in and present to the county commissioners, and off they went. They've already had two more meetings. So social science, I think, if you use it with your facilitation skills, you can, it actually wound up helping to, I think, allow people to start talking about, so what can we do? What do we agree on? What are the imperatives? What's the low-hanging fruit here? Then value of social science for specific high-conflict decision-making. So I've talked to you about the 447 project, the one that does have decision-making space, and we may be doing a future study regarding that. And then finally, as an institutional orientation tool, there was, in the Bridger Teach on National Forest, I would call that forest a high-functioning forest. I mean, the level of discourse in that forest is, in my experience, pretty darn high. And they were really talking about having these existential discussions about who are we, and what are we doing, and what's most important, especially with all this complexity and therefore this low morale. And the social science, again, it's helped identify, especially in combination with the spatial component, what are the areas of low-hanging fruit that they could concentrate their meager dollars and their meager time on and be as effective as possible. And it also identified what are our constituents most interested in. You know, because they may get the one or two squeaky wheels that come talking about, oh, this is very important, and if you don't do it, I'm going to my legislature, which everyone does in Wyoming. They've got all their legislators on speed dial over there. Again, you know, we've got more antelope than people in Wyoming, so that's another Alaskan thing. But if you put the squeaky wheels aside and you look at the generalized information, you extrapolate to the whole population, what winds up being most important to everyone? And without this social science data, they don't know that and they can't get to work on it. So it wound up being, to some extent, an enabling, empowering tool. So in conclusion, this is, you know, my experiences with one particular forest, and it was really a way for me to be able to find out for myself, if we're going to talk about science delivery on the ground, what is that, what can that look like? And I've tried some very basic, simple things, and it seems to have been very helpful. But I think the effectiveness will vary across forests and agencies and people and places. And I think bottom line, it'll always have very much to do with those gatekeepers and the personalities within that agency. If you have a couple of spark plugs that are engaged and interested, that will help very much. But of course, things like funding and what their priorities are going to be important factors too. As far as that paradox is concerned, I do think that for social science to be truly relevant, accessible, you know, they can get their hands on it, and usable, it needs to be on-the-ground application, or pracademics, as Steve Daniels calls it, or social science extension. But in order, if we're interested in advancing this, in order to help advance collaboration, we're going to have to find more ways and more funding for this kind of extension. Again, as far as I know, there isn't that much discussion about it. There isn't that much funding for it. It's not a subject that's right on top of the table. And I would love to talk about it more with anyone else who's interested in promoting this. As far as landscape and collaboration is concerned, social science is valuable as initiation and decision-making tool. I've already talked about that. Landscapes, collaboration, and legislation. Social science provides context. Without social science, and I'm talking to the choir, to those of us who are in human dimensions, but if we're going to talk about collaboration, these pieces of legislation mandate for us engage in collaboration. That's lovely. But then they give them absolutely no resources to do so. And yet the one thing that I think would allow collaboration to happen, to help is even a little bit of social science, a little bit of an empirical understanding of what are we talking about, who are the stakeholders, even if it's just to do the assessment before you engage in collaboration, which is also social science. Little bits of social science could make collaboration that much more efficient, which saves a lot of time, a lot of money, but also far more effective. And it's the missing link, ultimately, between making collaboration a reality and allowing people to connect through their discourse these complex issues, whether it's wildlife trails, oil and gas issues, in order to connect in our minds and our discourse together as people, to connect all these issues, social science, and I'm slotting discourse and facilitation in that right now. Whatever tools we have, the human component tools, that is the glue that makes it happen. That's the energy. Those are the molecules. That's the fuel. And I think social science can play a far greater role. And I know, I mean, if you go to an ISSRM conference, there are a ton of presentations on collaboration and how it works and how it doesn't work and all the different ways that people have been applying. And it's all over the world. It's very powerful. The science, the social science, can help even more, I think. That's my conclusion. So lastly, I just wanted to extend a huge thank to the Center for Collaborative Conservation. Thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been really, I have to say, Robin, I have to say that I was actually on the phone with a friend of mine the other day, and I was just all jazzed. I was there in my hotel room in Jackson, Wyoming, and I was talking to this friend, and it's like, you know, this is what being a social scientist is all about. And I got to experience it, so thank you very much. Also, great thanks to the Forest Service, specifically the Bridge of Teton National Forest. Michael Schroth and Brian Goldberg are my heroes. And Tony and the Colorado Forest Restoration Institute for being absolute diehard supporters. So, any questions?
Please field your own questions and ask directly.
So the data was collected in 2007, 2008, and I'm wondering what your perception is of how that may have changed since then, if the demographics have changed much, or if you think that the findings and the value placements are similar.
That's okay. Well, let me answer that one first. That's a really good point, and we've talked about it a lot, especially where the 447 project is. Jackie is saying, you know, well, just do you think it's still the same? My guess is it's time to do another. Not so much because I think the demographics have changed so much, although economic recession may play a role, but the discourse has changed. What we know, you know, the extent to which we're talking and thinking about things like hydraulic fracturing, and how much more we know. And, you know, there's been documentary saying that it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and others, of course, the HBO thing, that just pulverized the whole issue. So I think the discourse has changed, and so therefore, I think probably my hypothesis would be that more would be against oil and gas leasing, that there would be more concern about it now. There is research about oil and gas issues. I've done some research on that one. And if you look at the literature on oil and gas issues, it's really interesting because they make a distinction between more and less mature communities. And a community like Pinedale that is relatively mature where all these issues are concerned, if the folks in Pinedale could go back 10 years when it just started and say, you know, if you'd ask them, well, would you go about it in a different way, the answer would be yes. Right now, if somebody asked us, told us we're going to come in and do this, we would say, okay, but then we want this, this, and this more than what you gave us. They didn't know, but now they know. And so newer communities have a very different viewpoint on this than more mature communities. And because of that, because of the maturing process, I think it's time to do another one.
So your follow-up?
Thank you. Well, very much related to that, being, you know, would you focus on solely on the oil and gas issue or locust issues, or would you continue with the forest management?
If I really wanted to have a difficult time in life, I would make it just about oil and gas. So I think I would. We're talking about framing it.
Right.
And besides that, actually, it's ridiculous. If you've got a pot of money and you're going to use it for social science, don't just spend it on oil and gas. If there are other issues, of course, there are other issues. So there are wildlife issues. The conversation regarding forest restoration has increased considerably. In Wyoming, they have CFLRP envy. They want to have a CFLRP too. So there's other issues that we would add on. So it would be a mini version of what we did in 2007, 2000.
Jessica, do you see a lot of the agencies, as the older crew retire and newer people coming in, do you suspect that more of these social issues will be better received? Because they're going to have huge turnovers, they still being younger people, because they're being trained, such as CSU, more in social issues.
Yeah.
Do you think that'll have a make it easier for folks like
you? You know, that would be a lovely assumption to make. I know. I'm guilty of it, and it's really a great question, because in the BT they've had huge turnover, massive.
All over.
And I have to say, I'm not under the impression that just because someone is younger, that there's more familiarity with human dimensions or collaboration or the human component of things. I'm not going to say less, but it certainly doesn't appear to be more. That's one of the reasons why in March I'm going to go do another presentation, and this time it's for the leadership team, which is consisting now these days of mostly new people and a lot of younger people, because Michael Schrotz and Jackie and Brian, they want them to understand the value of this resource, because now everybody else in the forest does. But no, it actually almost seems that the more experienced, older, more mature, however you want to put that, Forest Service staff person, it's probably has had more exposure to it, mm-hmm. and is therefore more familiar with it.
So what does that say about the training at universities for putting out future natural resource managers? More social science?
Well, at CSU we're perfect, of course.
Yes.
You want to add in?
Yeah, I think, you know, I work for the Forest Service in research in social science. And I've been at it, you know, I did my undergraduate in forestry in the 70s, so I do think there are changes, you know, that over the span of 30 years, it's a very different business.
Yeah.
I think it's not just the age that's changing, it's the demographics of the agency personnel. So I went to a Region 6, which would be Washington, Oregon, meeting, leadership team meeting, was invited to a year and a half ago. And also all the forest supervisors, the regional forester, and all the main staff members. And sitting around the table for 2 days, I would say half of them are women. Mm-hmm. That's different, you know, from when I was young. So I think there's, on the one hand, it's a different kind of culture and awareness. On the other hand, I mean, I also tell people all the time, there are many forest services in the Forest Service. So there's an old guard. There's the enlightened forest supervisor who, like you say, very experienced, been around the block, and understands the social and political dimensions of what they do. And then there are those that seem to have been under a rock for their whole career. So, you know, the ones that have been under a rock, they're retiring and leaving and making space for a new group. But I think the challenge really is just that they're not essentially trained in a narrower version of forest management, but there might be just as many ecologists and other kinds of biologists who are trained in something a little bit different. And so you don't have to sort of monolithic forestry culture like you did maybe 30 years ago. So, I guess it's complicated. Part of my answer to that question, how is it changing?
Thank you, Dan, because that's a really important point. Dan's right. I mean, anyone who's been working with the Forest Service, many more women. And if there's one thing that values research shows, is that there is statistically a very big difference to how women value natural resources mm-hmm. and how men do. That's why we have to have both of them in the room. That's why it's so important. I'll leave it at that. But thanks, Dan. Yeah.
About the social scientists that you mentioned that works on the Bridger Teton.
Yes.
National Forest, and then what their role is and how they reacted to it.
John has been a quiet, brilliant, wonderful supporter and colleague to work with. But the way he looks at it, he's really working on NEPA documentation and the oil and gas issues, a very complex paperwork types of things and helping Jackie get that kind of documentation through and making sure that the socioeconomic part is well represented and discussed in all those documentations and uses the research that we've done all the time. But he's making sure that he's helping me be as relevant as possible to the folks in this particular forest by saying, okay, Jess, what people are really going to be interested in over there are these issues. And when you talk about it, make sure that you touch on these points. And he helps me from a social perspective. He translates the forest to me and helps me be far as effective as possible back to his forest so that he then wind up can use this information in a way that's helpful and relevant in his documentation. So that's been his role, Don.
So, we've been talking kind of broadly about social science. Really, within social science, you know, there's very different disciplines and approaches. And I'm just wondering, sort of, something that I've been working on and thinking about a lot recently, you know, how to better present, that information to decision makers and how to bring the best and the right social science tools and strengths to different projects. And I wonder if you have some thoughts about that.
That's a very broad question. Do you have anything specific in mind? Or?
Well, I guess I'm just thinking that when you say that social science, that maybe not knowing how to use the social science decision making, that maybe part of that problem stems from that there's not always a lot of integration or unity within the social sciences. And so as much as bringing that in with other sciences, the social sciences, there's some issues. And I'll couch this in that in 2013, so CSU's hosting ISSRM now is the theme of the ISSRM conference. So,
what is the theme?
A time for integration and looking at integration within the social sciences.
Good for you. Excellent. Thank you. Well, for sure. I mean, you're absolutely right. Of course, there are various kinds of social science. And so the kind of social science that I'm talking about is rooted in social psychology, what we call human dimensions. But then there's anthropology. And then there's geography. There's all these other social sciences. And do I have a lot of opportunity to work with individuals from those disciplines? I know. Would I like to? Of course. And I do think, that's one of the things that I think this was allowing me to do is, and this is also, I admit I have a bias for this methodology that I've been using for probably too long now, but but it's the combination of survey methodology and spatial tools. And Q study. This has become, my formula for doing social science. I know it very well, but I think it's so bloody effective, and you can tweak it in so many kinds of ways. But if I have a geographer or a GIS specialist helping me with the spatial component, because God knows I'm not one of those, then I'm already starting to integrate the disciplines. So, all I can say is I think it's incredibly helpful and very important having a conference to zero in on that would be very helpful. one of the things, I'll be honest, very honest, with all love for this institution, I have great love for CSU, I've been here for 20 years, but I have to say that after 20 years, the extent to which we have integrated the various disciplines, it's a lot less than I think it should be by now. Why is that? I'll leave that open. But there's a lot more to be done, and but I seem too enthusiastic.
Just to tag on to that, though, I think there is a point that, you know, in terms of trying to get out social science understood within an agency or culture or, you know, a community of resource practice that is maybe not trained in the social sciences, the fact that there are so many different varieties of social science is a barrier to understanding and communication. The different kinds of social science, different kinds of knowledge, it's actionable at different scales and different frames and so forth. And yet there's this kind of, so I see it in my research, you know, people above me, there's this sort of this one size notion of social science. We need more social science.
And yet,
that's good.
Terminology, in the same word might mean really different things from different disciplines.
Yeah, and it's not always clear what they mean your kind of social science when they say it. So anyway, I think that adds to some of the challenges of getting the values of social science across.
We're almost done. There was another question.
Well, but and my question is sort of on the extension piece of this.
Yes.
And so it's just sort of interesting to contemplate, because if we think about the Wharton Research Station and extension we do, you know, sort of across all of the our programs, which are, you know, biological sciences as well as social science.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting to contemplate sort of a particular. I guess I always think about some of the social science work sort of helping in general with doing extension work, and certainly I think some of the theory around the extension is this diffusion of innovation theory. So it's interesting to hear what you're talking about in terms of adult learning, because that's something new for me to think about in terms of sort of the theory behind extension, and is it different for social science than
And that's excellent point, Jeff. And what it gets at, I think, is that it's also a different way of going about extension. Rather than waiting for folks to say, okay, we've got an issue, can you help us? It's almost like we have to have a radar on for the minute people even start to think about, okay, maybe we should engage in a collaborative process. Social scientists should be there. Okay, let me help you.
Yeah.
And maybe help them, guide them through how can you make collaboration as effective as possible as another kind of social science. Help do the assessments. Help gather any kinds of larger scale data that might be necessary. But it's rather, I was reading this recently, again, this was more related to Ecological Society of America, but in this one ESA article, they were talking about how so often we come in with our science almost after the fact. Or actually, you know, if we could find ways of bringing it in earlier and help create science or tools, science delivery mechanisms with people on the ground. So it winds up being their tools. You know, it's like we have to get in earlier. Somehow it would be nice to have a radar so that we can help right from the ground up. And that's difficult. But then using adult theory and andragogy to help create tools and go about it in a way that works for all these, not just internal stakeholders, but external stakeholders. Yeah, I think there's a challenge there. All right, everyone.
That's it. Yes, thank you very much. If anyone needs a schedule for the rest of the semester, feel free to.
That's unit 2 on the model was to go in right at the very beginning. And the questions are driven by the community perspective. Right? Yeah, I mean, it's an obvious, you know, question in that. But anyway, this is an afternoon content. Yeah, not enough. No, you're well, it feels pretty lone ranger, you know, they're like, we should use this.